Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOTFM. This spring 2009 semester, Dr. Derek Frisbee, who is in the Department of History, is going to take some of his students on a unique excursion to the Pacific locales of Guam, Iwo Jima, and Peleliu, where some of the crucial battles of World War II were fought. It's all part of a history course that he's teaching, and what better definition of experiential learning is there than to actually go to the sites where the battles were fought and learn about them while you are on that turf? Dr. Derek Frisbee is here with us today to talk about this study abroad experience. Thanks for being here, Derek.
Oh, thanks, Jenna, for having me.
How did you come up with the idea for this?
Well, I grew up around Middle Tennessee, and I've always had the luxury of going to various Civil War battlefields that I've studied. And being a Marine myself, I've always studied the Pacific Island campaigns, especially Iwo Jima, which is so iconic, not only in Marine Corps traditions, but in the World War II military history. And after many of the films came out, Flags of Our Fathers, Letters from Iwo Jima, I thought, we are kind of spoiled in Middle Tennessee. We do have access to a lot of these battlefields, and maybe it's time that we go out and look how other people do their battlefields. We often forget that our battlefields here, for many years, were not protected battlefields. They weren't national parks. And it's been 150 years now since those battles took place, and you know, to see a battlefield 50 years after the battle is much different than seeing it 150 years. So this would be a unique chance for them to see these type of battlefields before the ravages of time and so forth catch up with them.
And there's another reason, in addition to the ravages of time, that makes the timing of this so especially unique and there's no time like the present, especially with regard to the Iwo Jima leg of the trip.
That's right. The Japanese government retook control over Iwo Jima in the 1960s. And since that time, they have always allowed veterans, both Japanese and Americans, to hold reunions on the island. Many American units have offloaded on Iwo Jima and held their own memorial services and these kind of things. But with the World War II generation passing away now, the Japanese have decided to pretty much close Iwo Jima off to civilian visits. So this may be one of the last years, and I from what I've heard, I think this is probably one of the last two or three years at least that they will allow visitors to the island.
Is it a pollution problem, a population problem, an infrastructure problem?
It's largely an infrastructure problem. On Iwo Jima, there are no ports. You have to sort of make an amphibious landing or an air landing to get there. All the supplies have to be brought in that way. Also, it is a military installation. It is a Japanese military installation. And so these civilian visits have always been limited to one day out of the entire year. And the logistical support required to bring in civilians to this location, for safety reasons, it's honeycombed with caves, many of which have still not been fully explored, and the unexploded ordnance and these kind of things that exist there, it's very dangerous. It could be very dangerous. And so the Japanese government has just pretty much said, with the veterans passing away, that this will be one of the last years that they do this, if not the last.
The very fact that it's as hard to get there as you say it is should give students an appreciation of the topographical challenges that the Allies had to face when they invaded the island.
Yeah, this is one of the things that the battlefield experience provides you, and this is why we do many staff rides, various locations, battlefields like Murfreesboro, Franklin, Shiloh, in the Civil War period. To go to these Pacific battlefields and get an idea of the distances involved. We look on a map, it's the distance of our index finger from many of these places, but to get out there and realize that it takes, several hours by plane and many days by boat to travel from one island to the other, this island hopping campaign the Allies engaged in was a huge logistical challenge to overcome. And you get a sense of why they took certain islands and why they bypassed others. For instance, Guam is really the linchpin of this whole campaign because it's one of the biggest ports in the Marianas Islands specifically, which is the next step to the Japanese home islands, also has one of the only fresh water supplies available in adequate amounts there. So, Guam is one piece of the puzzle. in order to combine the two prongs of this of the Pacific offensive, one MacArthur's offensive toward the Philippines and the other the Marine Corps Navy offensive towards Japan, you have to go to Peleliu. And so this is why Peleliu becomes such an important part of it, because of the airfields there that the Japanese could have used to thwart one prong or the other, or both. And then, of course, Iwo Jima has always stood halfway between Tinian and Saipan and Japan itself. And it was an early warning site for the Japanese to let them know the B-29s were coming. And it also sort of had fighter cover to intercept the bombers. And on the return trip, these bombers were sort of at their limits in terms of the fuel and bomb loads that they carried. So any damage to an American B-29, they probably were not going to make it back. And Iwo Jima would serve sort of as a rescue island for the B-29 crews.
Now, Guam is a U.S. territory, but since you've actually been to Iwo Jima, how would you assess the Japanese attitude toward historic preservation versus the American attitude toward historic preservation? Is there a different sensibility going on there?
Well, in the Pacific, it is sort of interesting to study this. The Japanese, as far as I'm aware, do not have any sort of memorials other than some of the shrines on Japan's home islands. I have not seen any of the Pacific memorials that Japan has put up, if at all. But, you know, in Iwo Jima's case, it's almost like their Arlington Cemetery. This was the first of the Japanese home islands that were invaded. It was very symbolic to them. And there are still several thousand Japanese unaccounted for at this location. So it is really sort of a graveyard, a cemetery for them, and it's a sacred place.
But your students are probably not expecting to find, you know, the old stereotype is the World War II soldier who hid back in the cave and comes out 50 years later not realizing that the war is over.
Well, you know, that's an interesting part of the story we're going to talk about. On Guam, the last Japanese soldier surrendered in 1972.
So he was back in a cave.
He was living out in the jungle in a cave and was discovered by some hunters. What many people don't realize about Iwo Jima is that though the battle took 36 days, it wasn't until 1947-48 that some of the last survivors popped up out of the cave.
They were had to be extraordinarily self-sufficient in being able to be practically survivalist and live off the land.
That's right. The last two Japanese soldiers came out in 47 or 48. They had lived off stolen supplies, and they finally saw a picture of MacArthur and the Emperor together on a magazine that they had stolen from some of the Americans that were based there, and realized that since MacArthur wasn't bowing to the Emperor, that Japan had truly lost the war, and decided that they would give themselves up. And they just walked out of the caves and were found by a group of American mechanics just riding around the base.
Did he just surrender, or
they? From what I understand, the story on Iwo Jima, they were sort of seen as hitchhikers. They thought they were some Chinese sailors who had gotten stranded on the island, and they got back to the base after they brought them in and learned that they were Japanese soldiers who had lived in the caves.
Okay. Are Guam and Peleliu more accessible than Iwo Jima?
Yeah, many people aren't aware that the National Park System actually runs a World War II in the Pacific park from Guam, of which we have an MTSU student who's a park ranger there now, which is sort of an added bonus for us to get to go visit one of our students, you know, at his job site.
Yeah.
Pretty exotic job site at that.
And there are enough people in Guam that the Democrats and Republicans have a Guam primary.
That's right.
We've had two Guam primaries earlier this year.
That's right. And they're very important primaries, as it turned out, for a change. So Guam runs sort of a National Park Service. We also have some students here that have worked with the Peleliu Historical Society, and they want to integrate the Peleliu location into this national park in the Pacific with the Park Service. And so they've done some historical mapping, and so we have some tie-ins there as well. Peleliu is in the Palau Islands, and they use the U.S. dollar. And Guam is, of course, an American territory. So one of the added benefits of this trip is that we don't have to worry about currency exchange rates. We're going to be using the dollar all the time. But, yeah, I mean, there is a growing market for this kind of tourism. And that's a very different take on the story than what many people thought would happen. Once the veterans died out, many people thought that this this tourism in World War II would sort of die out. But just like in the Civil War, we're finding out 50, 70 years after the battles, the children and the grandchildren are becoming more interested in finding out what their fathers and grandfathers or uncles and so forth went through. And they're visiting these battlefields, and there's money to be made in historical tourism, as Murfreesboro well knows.
Is the fact that the U.S. dollar is weak right now going to be their gain and our loss?
Well, I have no idea. I'm not a financial analyst, but
is it going to be a challenge for the people going with you in terms of what they might want to buy?
I would say it would probably be one of the better trips for this, because, you know, being on the U.S. dollar, it wouldn't affect too much of having to worry about whether you're winning or losing. Mm-hmm. And that, I know, you know, I've been to Europe several times, and you always have to worry about, you know, what is this? Am I winning or losing in that exchange rate? So it simplifies things a lot.
We don't seem to hear much about Peleliu, unless you happen to be a World War II buff. Why not?
Well, Peleliu is a very controversial operation. It was known as Operation Stalemate. In this operation, the Navy and the Marine Corps were with the Joint Army unit intending to help out MacArthur's retaking of the Philippines. It turned out that the island of Peleliu was not necessary for the retaking of the Philippines. The air bases on Peleliu were never really used to repel MacArthur's advance. Excuse me. And there were a lot of intelligence problems on Peleliu. The aerial reconnaissance did not show the rocky ridges on top of the mountains more inland from the beaches. And what was supposed to take 3 days turned into a 76-day ordeal in which the Marines suffered tremendous casualties. It was one of the first times that the Japanese tried the new strategy of letting the Americans get ashore without really challenging the landings, draw them into the interior of the jungle and the cave systems, and then attempt to repulse the invasion. And it cost a lot of people their lives.
Why was the aerial reconnaissance incomplete? Was it human error or inadequate technology?
It's inadequate technology, and it's a failure. Well, it's inadequate technology in some ways, and a reliance on technology in another. They didn't have GPS, global positioning systems, like we do today. They don't have infrared mapping or geoscience studies. And so they relied on aerial reconnaissance alone, and it only provided them really a two-dimensional image, and they couldn't see through the jungle canopy. And this, you know, that reliance upon just the aerial photos alone, they failed to get human intelligence on what was underneath that canopy. And underneath that canopy are a series of rocky outcroppings that the Marines eventually came to know as Bloody Nose Ridge. And it was just it was savage hand-to-hand fighting to take those positions, and it was just tragic for both sides.
As opposed to hiding in the foliage and using guns, it was literally fists and knives and
That's correct.
And up close and personal carnage.
Up close and personal carnage. And this is where the Japanese sort of learned that you could negate American air power not only by building the tunnels, but also getting very close to the American units. The closer you were to the American units, the less likely they were to call in overwhelming firepower sort of on themselves. So they learned, as we say in the military, to hug the enemy and negate a lot of the firepower advantages the Americans would have had.
Mm. Suppose you are not a history major. Suppose you have other majors, and you're not particularly a World War II buff, but the idea of this trip intrigues you, and you want to do a study abroad experience. What would you gain from the experience from going on this trip, in addition to obviously the credit? How do you make this particular credit applicable to whatever your major happens to be, whether it's medicine or business or English or whatever it is?
Well, that's really the great aspect and great benefit of a study abroad program, is that, especially when they're faculty-led programs like this one, the faculty members can pretty much tailor the experience to the individual students. If you're a medical or pre-med major, interested in medical sciences. I can tailor a program to you to learn about medicine in the Pacific. You can study how the soldiers dealt with diseases as well as combat injuries. We've got inquiries from people who want to study volcanic activity. Iwo Jima is a volcanic island. And so they want to go and you know, see an inactive volcano like Iwo Jima. Forensic science. The forensic science program, people have been very interested in this because there are still human remains, you know, visible in these areas and still unaccounted for. And it would be interesting to sort of look at how the American military and the American public have dealt with the issue of you know, remains recovery, how the Japanese deal with this. As I said, there are reports, you know, that there are still mummified remains of Japanese soldiers still in the caves on Iwo Jima in particular. But they're just too hazardous to go in there and do any kind of real work. So, you know, how did the Japanese deal with that? How did the Americans retrieve the bodies and bring them to Hawaii? We can tailor it a number of ways depending on what your major is. So just because you're not a military history buff or you're not a history major shouldn't dissuade you from joining this if you're interested in going to the Pacific, learning about Pacific culture. And we can custom make a program for you that you'll definitely get the benefit out of it.
In order to give the student that kind of individualized experience, do you have to keep a lower cap on the number of students you can take on this excursion than you'd say closer to the number you would find in an honors class rather than, say, a survey class?
Well, there's no limit on how many we can take, but definitely it usually turns out it's a smaller class size. It is more like between 15 and 20 people as opposed to 35, 40, 235 students that we normally take. So it is much easier to get that one-on-one experience with someone.
Have you done a lot of study abroad classes?
I have not. This will be my first one, although I did take one of the earlier forms of study abroad when I was in school here. We went to Ecuador with Dr. Mario Perez Riley in the political science department, and we studied the politics of Ecuador and the educational system in Ecuador. We worked with a college down there. And so I've been on these programs before, and I'm very excited about the opportunity to be able to lead one myself for change.
Okay, now the nuts and bolts. Suppose, especially if you've never traveled abroad before in your life, and this is the first time, what do you tell a student? Make sure you take this, this, and this. Make sure you don't take this, this, and this. This is what you need to know about going through the airport and not getting caught by the TSA. What do you tell them about the basics of surviving travel that far away from home?
Well, the first thing you have to do is get a passport, and you have to apply early. It's well chronicled, the delays in the passport system, so we have to get that taken care of right away. There's some paperwork we need to fill out. The only visa that really is required will be that on Iwo Jima and the Palau Islands. Guam is an American territory, so it's not too much of a hassle there, and we can deal with the American officials there. But as far as the air travel itself goes, the biggest problem is really physical more than anything else. Getting your body mentally prepared to go undergo the dateline change and hydration on these air travel trips, and especially to avoid jet lag, hydration is really the key part of that. So you have to stay hydrated, and you have to make sure that you don't engage in any excessive behavior while you're over there to sort of exacerbate the effects of jet lag. So there'll be a couple of days that we get acclimatized to the heat.
What's the weather going to be like?
Acclimatized to the time change. The weather there, now I understand last year when they went to Iwo Jima, they're often on rain showers there all day, but it doesn't pose too much of a problem.
And this will be in March, right?
This will be in March. Mm-hmm. Guam, the weather there is tropical. You can have heavy rains during certain areas and summertime, and then very hot, humid weather other times. The temperatures usually average between 75 and 80 degrees on Guam. It's a very beautiful hotel that we'll be staying at on Guam. It's a resort hotel called the Outrigger. And then on Palau, probably the toughest part of the journey, the Peleliu trip in many ways, because it will require some hiking up these rocky ridges. And that's another aspect of it. On Iwo Jima this year, there will be no U.S. naval logistical support. So we will have to walk the island by ourselves rather than ride in Humvees from point to point.
So it would behoove you to be in good physical condition and to if you have any medications.
Yes, and that's the study abroad program has policies and procedures for getting medications and medical emergencies and those kind of things. But generally, you'll need some moderately good physical fitness to travel with us.
Is there any cultural protocol that you need to bone up on with regard to Iwo Jima and Peleliu so that you don't offend the native population?
Well, on Peleliu, it's wanting to become part of this national park. And so on Guam, it's an American territory. So as long as you behave yourself on those two places, you'll be fine. Iwo Jima is a little bit different story. For both sides, it becomes such an emotional battle that when we're there, they'll need to have a certain level of respect and reverence for the opportunity to be there. Especially when we have a ceremony on top of Mount Suribachi where the flag was raised. That typically is where the American and Japanese veterans meet for what they call a reunion of honor. And this will be the 64th reunion of honor that they've performed there. So on those places, we'll need to have a sense that we are on to what many people consider sacred ground.
Leave your stupid jokes at home.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. With regard to funding, this is the part of the trip nobody likes to talk about, but it's study abroad excursions that emanate from this university are relatively cheap, in part, in many cases, because people who have traveled abroad before have contacts that they have dealt with in the past, and it helped to, cut the costs down. So tell us a little bit about the dollars and cents.
Well, the dollars and cents are the parts that no one likes to talk about, but it really is a great educational bargain when you think about it. We're going to fly from here to Guam, essentially, and we're going to travel by plane to Iwo Jima and then come back to Guam, take a plane to Koror, Palau, and then take a boat to Peleliu and those kind of things. So it does get sort of expensive. The base cost for that tour runs upwards of $4,000, $5,000, depending on various aspects of the trip. But the study abroad program actually provides students who enroll in the course with the opportunity to pay up to 50% of their tuition for this trip by applying for a scholarship. You need a 2.75 GPA. You need a letter of recommendation from a professor. It can't be the one that's taking on the trip.
Now, that would be a conflict of interest.
That would be a conflict of interest. But if selected, you can earn up to half the cost of the trip for students. And so I think that's a great program. I think MTSU really has sort of made the world our campus in that regard. We're opening up the entire world as our campus, and so that there will be no boundaries for us. And this is a great program, and I would encourage any student that wanted to go to investigate that study abroad scholarship option.
And with regard to Iwo Jima in particular, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. You may never get this chance again.
It may never come again. And the study abroad people have just done fascinating work in providing students with the information they need to talk to financial aid. Financial aid will adjust your budget somewhat because the cost is obviously above and beyond what normal classes here cost. So there'll be some financial aid adjustments made to your financial aid package. Then you'll apply for the scholarship and these sorts of things. So MTSU couldn't make it easier for you to take this trip. And it is such a unique experience that people may never get again.
And if you already have some financial aid, it can be applied to this particular trip, even if you don't get the scholarship. If you already have some loans or some grants or something like that, you can have that applied to the cost of the trip.
That's correct. You can apply your student loan monies and tuition monies, assistance monies to this trip. It's an educational. It's a class.
Yeah. The South Pacific has kind of been fabled in story and song, thanks to Rodgers and Hammerstein and all that. Talk about a little bit, since you've actually been there, about myth versus reality.
Right.
The romanticism versus reality, and how much is real and how much is poetic license.
Well, it's a very beautiful place. It's much different than the mountains of Tennessee that you see here. To be able to stand on an island and get a 360-degree view of nothing but ocean around you can be a little disconcerting for those of you who prefer land over water.
Or come from a landlocked state like
yeah,
Tennessee.
That's right. So it can be a little bit unnerving to have all that water around you. You know, the South Pacific is a seismically active place, and it's not unusual to have some rumblings underneath your feet every once in a while. And it's just a very unfamiliar environment for so many people in the eastern United States to be in a tropical environment with the heat and the humidity and these kind of things. It can be a little overwhelming to people, but the citizens there are just fabulous hosts. The hospitality there is paralleled only by that of ours here in the South, I would say.
How about the South Pacific strategically, from the standpoint of U.S. military installations in the general region? Are they still as important as they were during the Cold War?
Not so much. And this is one of the problems I think that many of the South Pacific Islands are facing, is they don't have the funding that the American military once brought into that region. Thanks to satellites and drones and long-range aircraft and nuclear-powered ships that don't need to, you know, pull in for fuel, coaling stations is originally what many of these islands were used for. They don't have that investment, the American investment that they once did. So a lot of these islands are turning back to tourism. For their incomes.
This is a Department of Defense reprioritization?
No, that's correct. Largely due just to reinvestments in technology, whereas before the idea was to sort of protect the perimeter, almost every inch, not let the domino theory start. Now it's more of a mobile defense network that can be used by our ships and a few air bases like those on Guam to take care of reconnaissance and such.
So how do you get lucky enough to be sent to Guam if you're in the military instead of being sent to, the border between North and South Korea?
Well, you join the Air Force rather than the Army or the Marine Corps. But the Air Force has a very large base there. The Navy has a very active base there for their aircraft and for some of their submarines and such. But generally, you're not lucky enough to be stationed on Guam. You may visit Guam every once in a while, but very few people get the luxury of being stationed on Guam. But it's such a beautiful place. It's one of the largest islands in that particular chain. I think it's 55 miles long, and it's just got beautiful beaches and coral reefs and it's got that very characteristic blue water, green water, effect to it. So it should be a great place to visit. And our students on Guam have just bragged about it, and they send me pictures almost every week to keep my interest up.
Are you taking your wife? And if you aren't, has she started divorce proceedings yet?
No, she can't go with us this time. We have a new baby in the house, 5 weeks old this week, and so somebody has to stay behind and hold down the fort, as we say. And plus, given the level of physical activity it's going to require, she's kind of excited that I have to regain my Marine Corps physique in order to be able to go here. I've kind of lost that sitting at a desk for the last few years. So she's excited that she might actually get me to work out a little bit more often than I do.
And if you want to know more about the Central Pacific World War II battlefield trip for the spring 2009 semester, email Derek at dfrisby, D-F-R-I-S-B-Y, at mtsu.edu, or you can go to his website, which is www.mtsu.edu/tilde-dfrisby, right?
That's correct.
And your office phone number?
494-8620.
Area code 615.
That's correct.
Derek, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Jenna. I appreciate talking to you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loke. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can go to mtsunews.com and check out the podcast at your leisure, and we're also available on iTunes.